Oh, such a clutch off-season pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Shop Blinds.com right now and get up to 40% off select styles, plus a free professional measure and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Save up to 40% at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
sleeper. Join our league of clean energy at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping and have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle all your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off USPS and UPS. Add flexibility to your day with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
Welcome back, folks. Every Tuesday at this hour, we have our NOLA Coalition segment. We meet with difference makers that are giving back to the community in so many different ways. And today's no different. We are joined by Brian Lagarde, Executive Director of Project NOLA. Brian, it's been a long time. Good to hear you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show today.
So, Brian, an interesting article the other day on NOLA.com, Missy Wilkinson talks about your experience with the Crime Camera program, you saying you never slept that night. You were able to view the whole horrific events of that evening. Tell us about it.
Well, I think I know a lot of people who didn't sleep that night. So it was a tragic, extraordinarily regrettable, very devastating event. Something that even considering the fact that we're involved in so many homicides, shootings, stabbings, you know, the worst that regrettably the city sees, this topped it. But to see how the responding officers came through, how brave they were, it was something to be part of. I wish, you know, we all wish it didn't happen, but I'm extraordinarily proud of how well NOPD, LSP, everyone responded and to the situation.
Absolutely. And you've played a critical role, at least the cameras have, right, in capturing the movements of the perpetrator of this horrific event and being able to piece a story together in a quick fashion, which is exactly what this system was designed to do, right?
Exactly. So we have tools available to us, including clothing recognition, license plate recognition, facial recognition, bicycle recognition, that helps us pick suspects out of a crowd and go back in history, see what they did, where they were, who they were with, things of that sort. We did work in close cooperation with the city's real-time crime center. So there's parts that they can see that we can't and parts that we can see that they can't. So it was very much, a coordinated effort.
Brian, you would agree this is the classic example of more is better, right? More cameras, the better
for
able
sure.
to put piece together the story.
So, you know, we all learned lessons. One of the lessons that we learned is even though each one of our cameras can see, actually, we can clearly see a face from multiple city blocks with our cameras. But when it came to devices on the ground that were so low, we could only see the devices when there was a break in the crowd. So that's part of what it made it extremely challenging afterwards to go ahead and track everybody that touched the devices and to reconstruct exactly how they moved, you know, one of them in particular moved from point A to point B.
Right, and you're talking about the ice chest where the incendiary improvised incendiary device was located?
Yes.
I understand. How soon, like after the event, were you in a position to actually forward a lot of this over to the law enforcement side?
It all unfolded in real time. It's pretty much as soon as it occurred. As officers were responding to the situation, the first thing that we started doing, we were tasked to do, was to see if there's anyone else involved. The game plan very quickly changed after the first device was found. And then it was, tracking, the movements of those devices, who ultimately planted the devices, things of that sort.
And as many tools as you have on the system, I have to imagine, or if you would describe, it's still got to be a tedious process going through this second by second, minute by minute, right?
It is. So although facial recognition is extremely accurate, clothing recognition, it can be, multiple people wearing similar clothing. And not all of our cameras have, our older cameras don't have those features. So there was a lot of reviewing video footage by hand is extremely tedious. When you're watching, regardless of what type of crime it might involve, it usually we're going frame by frame by frame, trying to extract every single detail of information.
Yeah. If you had a magic wand and you could wave it today, I know that there's going to be an after action review of this. There's going to be multiple investigations. I think you have a sense of, if we could improve what we have down there from a technology standpoint, what would it be in your mind?
I can certainly tell you what we're looking to improve on ourselves. So we are, it broke our hearts when we found out, when we realized that he was actually in town in October. And we didn't have any video footage of that. It is already, our video retention policy for privacy purposes is approximately 30 days. And so it just didn't register in our systems that he was here prior to that. So one of the things that we did, given what happened, is we are extending our video retention policy for the CBD, DDD, French Quarter, and Frenchman Entertainment District, pretty much all of the 8 districts, right, so that we won't have that happen to us again. We're also are going to, most of our priorities have been helping to prevent and solve homicide, shooting, stabbings, home invasion, rape, robberies, thefts, burglaries. So now we're having to think about the unthinkable. And towards that end, we're now beginning to place cameras that can automatically detect suspicious objects that are left behind by people. So that's going to help us in the future. Should we need to go ahead and find who did something with a particular object, it's going to help us track that type of movement very much, much more easily.
Yeah, and are you utilizing AI tools?
Oh, absolutely. The best that we know of in the United States. So the only entity that we know of in the entire Western world that has the capabilities that we do is the Metropolitan Police in London. So the live facial recognition, the passive facial recognition, the ability for our cameras to automatically detect criminals live and in real time, the moment that they step into the French Quarter, if it's a wanted subject, and automatically sends alerts to the NOPD, Troop NOLA, NOPD Vows Unit, things like that. To my understanding, we're the only entity in the United States that does it, does what we do to the great level of success that we do it with, so extremely socially responsibly, in a social responsible manner.
Yeah. What do they call that system in London? Ring of Fire? If my memory serves me correct, something like that.
I don't recall. That does ring a bell, though.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I met with folks from London when we were deploying our ALPR cameras, which is right around, I think, the first time that you and I met back right. then. And it was, their system was so impressive, you know, and that was probably 20 years ago now. I can't even imagine what it's like today with the utilization of AI. I mean, what they were able to detect and forward on to officers on the street real time was just mind-boggling to me.
And what you did with JPSO was also really ahead of the time, especially with the number of license plate recognition cameras that you put out there and their capabilities. So kudos to you as well. They have evolved. So back in the day, you were only able to look for a vehicle based off a license plate. We have the ability to look for a vehicle based off of make, body style, color, dents, dings, uniquely identifiable markers. We can do the same with bicycles. So it's not just vehicles, it's bicycles, motorcycles, motor scooters. So we can set our AI to look for a particular vehicle, and it'll help us find that automatically, instantly.
How important is lighting for you guys in the French Quarter? You know, they have been on a three-year trek. We were talking to Glade Bilby the other day from the French Quarter Citizens Association and French Quarter Management District. Seems like it's been taking forever to do this $7 million project with lighting. Got to imagine it would help.
Lighting, I mean, just the rules of photography. Lighting is a good thing. Now, realistically, with the level of cameras that we use and the chipsets that are in the cameras, they are extraordinarily special. They're Starlight chips. They basically turn night into day. So it's unusual for cameras to have these type of chips in them. But where other cameras are not able to see well at night, we're able to see extremely well. Now, our cameras also, for a lot of our cameras that we provide, they have lights on them. It's not that the camera needs them. It's used as an active deterrent. So let's say you have a camera on your house pointing out towards your driveway. Somebody walks up to pull your door handles. Next thing you know, they're, red and blue lights light up, and then there's a spotlight that lights up on the camera, and it can even do an audio outgoing message. If it's one of our pan, tilt, zoom cameras that automatically track people, it automatically turns left, right, up, down, zooms in, zooms out, can spin 360 degrees, then it'll actually point the lights towards that person, light them up. So when it comes to lighting, it's good. You need lighting in the French Quarter so that people can see and they don't trip on, potholes and things like that. And frankly, it's one of those things that you can do to help harden an area. When it comes to at least the cameras that we provide, lighting is good, but it's certainly not necessary.
Yeah, it's not a difference maker. How about the city cameras?
Well, what about them?
I've got to imagine they don't have and it's not a criticism. It's not a criticism, but I'm sure they probably don't have the Starlight chip.
They don't. They do not. So the city cameras do pale in comparison to ours. So we're able to shoot at a much higher definition. So we're able to shoot all the way up to 8K, actually a little bit above 8K. The city cameras, most of those are still 720p, at the very most 1080p. So even if they have cameras that are technically higher than that, like a 4K camera, their system records a recorder only in typically 720p, 1080p, and they certainly do not have the same Starlight chips that we put in our cameras. So the differences are huge between the picture quality from our cameras and the picture quality from the city cameras.
Yeah, I mean, 720p is almost really first-generation technology, right?
It is first-generation technology, yes. First-generation digital, high-definition, yes.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, I guess that's one of the things and one of the challenges as you deploy security measures. The highest and best use of your system is probably the day that you deploy it, right? I used to call it planned obsolescence, because you deploy this equipment knowing that within a very short period of time, what you're deploying very well could be obsolete in a year or two. Because that's how fast technology has been growing, right?
Absolutely. So we usually do see ourselves a couple of years ahead of the curve, like the auto tracking cameras that automatically turn. That if you walk around the French Quarter, you can tell which ones are ours because the camera's constantly turning. and they'll face towards you for a few seconds to get a really good picture of you. And then they'll move on to another person. So you walk around, you see a camera moving. It's going to be one of ours, most likely. Now what we do with our crime camera host, so how that even works, just to kind of describe to people, is, of course, we're a nonprofit organization. We operate the National Real-Time Crime Center located at the University of New Orleans. We use donations to actually purchase the cameras. So whether you want to host one on your house or someone wants to host one on their business, they're not buying these cameras from us. We literally give them away. All anyone pays us is the little bit that it costs us to receive, record, rebroadcast, which can be as little as $300 a year, and that is tax deductible. So the cameras go up, but concerning them becoming obsolete is because we're giving these cameras away, because we're a nonprofit and our mission is to help reduce crime and not to make money. Guess what we do? After 5 years, we're going to notify you. Hey, it's been 5 years. Thank you very much for hosting our crime cameras. You know, we've done a lot of good things with it. We want to go ahead and provide you with an upgraded model. It's not going to cost you a penny. So we give people the choice 5 years into the future if they want to keep their existing camera or if they want to switch it out for, the latest and greatest. So that way we always have the really good cameras out on the street.
Yeah. Is there a priority for you guys from your business model as it relates to these high pedestrian trafficked areas that you try and get the latest and greatest cameras on people's private property?
So everywhere is a priority to us. So crime happens everywhere. You never know where it's going to happen next. Right now there is a large push to do what we can around the CBD and French Quarter in preparation for the Super Bowl, something we've actually been working on for the past year, along with the NOPD, LSP, and others, NOLA Coalition, and, everybody. So, whether you live in the French Quarter or you live somewhere else, the Lower Ninth, New Orleans East, Lakeview, Lake Vista, Uptown, doesn't matter. You call us and you're looking for help, we're going to help you.
Yeah, that is an absolutely incredible service because it's all, as you well know, you've been around this for a long, long time. It's all about selective incapacitation of the impact criminal. And that's how we create safety and security in our community. And the sooner that you get your hands around these knuckleheads and lock them up, the better off the community is going to be. And I can't thank you. It's really good to hear your voice. It's been a long time. You have been incredibly successful with this endeavor and really a huge contributor to the successes that we've had in the city in fighting crime, and we thank you for saying.
Thank you. Thank you for the kind words. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Brian Lagarde, Executive Director, Project NOLA. Have a great week. We will be right back, 504-260-1870. When we return, we'll visit with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member at large.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Hey guys, it's Jim Costa from Cash the Ticket. If you're betting the NFL playoffs, you need to be listening to Cash the Ticket. We're breaking down every single game, totals, and sides, all the way to the big game. Subscribe to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by New Orleans City Council Member at Large, J.P. Morrell. J.P., Happy New Year to you and welcome to the show.
Thank you. No, happy to be here.
JP, I understand that the New Orleans City Council is about to embark upon an investigation review of the policies, procedures, and against protocols of security in the French Quarter. What do you guys intend to look at, and what do you hope comes out of this process?
Well, I mean, it's a little more specific than that. We're actually looking at all of the infrastructure and security all of the infrastructure and security that deals with the French Quarter since about 2019, when that FQMD report happened, through New Year's. As you know, the Attorney General is doing a separate investigation, which is really dealing with the immediate time preceding the New Year's attack, about from December 6th when that FBI bulletin went out, through the attack itself. We're looking at what happened with the infrastructure investments or lack thereof, and kind of what policies or what practices have been placed to prevent the French Quarter from ever implementing the concerns that came out of the FQMD report, as well as some common sense concerns. Additionally, as you know, millions of dollars were spent on these go-kart barricades that apparently were installed, and we're really getting to the bottom of how a decision was made to replace the old barricades that, though cumbersome, old, and difficult to manage, were actually capable of preventing attack, and replacing them with what are essentially decorative go-kart bollards, which every security professional has said would not have prevented this attack.
So who actually handled the procurement of that? Was that a Department of Public Works project?
So yes and no. So that's part of, and honestly, Oliver, I mean, honestly, that's part of what the conflict is, like with these various like dual investigations on the council. We are just beginning. My staff and I began right after the attack on Friday morning, pulling all of the documents as the bollard situation came closer into focus. And every time we uncover information dealing with this procurement process to get those bollards selected and installed, every piece of paper we pull, Newell, generates more questions. Ultimately, the end product was a DPW managed project that led to those bollards being installed. But even the initial timeline is off, because as you know, there was a press release sent out by the mayor the day of the attack, kind of like addressing the bollard situation. I think it was sent out like almost 2 or 3 o'clock that day, which was kind of bizarre in itself. But the timeline regarding the bollards even then was off, because it said that the bollard construction began in November and it was supposed to be finished by the Super Bowl. Well, as we saw that coming out, we were getting verbal confirmation within DPW that the contract was supposed to start in September, and that potentially there was a conflict with a subcontractor, which delayed the project getting started by November when the primary took over for the sub. And these are the kind of things, Newell, like the reason why our investigation, which is going to fully kick off on Thursday when the council opens the official investigation, it's really a bit more long form and not knee jerk, is that this is going to require the subpoena of documents from a variety of organizations. It's going to require us to collect all that information. And as you know from our previous investigations, Newell, once we have the information in front of us, like a lawyer doing interrogatories, that's when we start having the interviews and the hearings. And so we're going to get to the bottom of this in a completely transparent and public way, how the heck we went from a infrastructure security plan that began with Mayor Landrieu that had bollards installed, good or bad, but that could at least withstand a U-Haul truck going 40 miles per hour, and how we went from there to the go-kart bollards that couldn't stop anything, and who made those decisions at what times. And more importantly, because you know you can't deal with hearsay in an investigation, getting all the document production so that we're not speculating who made decisions, but we see between documents and testimony how these bad decisions were made. And I want to emphasize, Newell, one of the biggest problems I have right now, personally as a council member, is millions of dollars were spent to install these bollards, which are useless, which means not only are they useless, we have to pull them back up, start over, and install bollards that do work and pay for those as well.
So at the present time, you don't really know whether or not the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness had any say in this process or any input, nor do you know whether or not the NOPD had any say or input in the process.
I can say with some certainty that the NOPD and Homeland Security had input on these bollards. What I can also say and I can't go too deep in it because we're in this investigation, is that a variety of other groups also had say in what that security looked like, and that in itself might be a problem. I think what you see from the CNN reporting today, from the very chatty security people who did the first FQMD report in 2019, is there has always been a tension in the French Quarter in particular when it comes to securing the French Quarter versus the ease of use of entering and exiting the French Quarter. And you've known this for years, Newell, because you've experienced the French Quarter. As a law enforcement professional, you know that security is inconvenient. And I think that that tension, from what I've seen, and I think that's kind of where that security report, and we're going to actually subpoena those individuals as well to get, because they make a lot of like allusions in the CNN reporting about how there were people that were obstructionists, but they won't name who the people are. Well, we're going to get to that in our investigation, because at the end of the day, we need to get down to the real basics of how these decisions were made and were they done, and was the primary driving force of this decision making what is the safest outcome, or were there other considerations that overruled security being the primary issue, if that makes sense. And as we go forward, and I mean, I think something that people really haven't wrapped their head around, now that we have Mardi Gras in New Orleans elevated to a SEER 1 classification, we really don't know at this point, and I'm having meetings today about it as well, but like, there really is no telling what Mardi Gras is going to look like during Mardi Gras season. Because, Noel, you know, with SEER 1, if a federal security personnel person who's advising us, providing resources, goes, this particular Mardi Gras route is impossible of being secured, they will change it. And that just will be what it is. And those are the kind of things we're still, I think people don't even have their heads wrapped around. Because as you know, I mean, I'll be very candid, the Endymion route is in very difficult, if not impossible, to secure as a route. We've had two mass casualty events at Endymion that were both drunk drivers, not even terrorists.
Yeah.
And a security professional from the federal level is going to opine on what that route looks like. And when they give us that opinion, Newell, that'll be the route.
Well, but I mean, part of the remediation, as you well know, JP, is just going to be simply the closing of streets. I mean, you have that situation with the uptown route, with having the north side of St. Charles Avenue open to traffic. I mean, that presents all kinds of challenges. If you take this terrorist and you put him on that street on any given Mardi Gras day, and he decides to hit the neutral ground, and now that you don't have tents and barbecue pits that would serve as an obstruction to a vehicle, actually, the risk is even greater today, because once he hits the neutral ground, that's it. He can go for a mile and a half.
Well, I mean, there were tents and other things on the Endymion route when the drunk driver ran over everybody last time. So I would give a little pushback on that. But what I'm saying is that they serve
as obstructions that possibly could get locked up in the wheel or otherwise. But, you know, human bodies, not to be too graphic here, but I mean, you know, it's just not the same.
And, well, I think the other issue with the Endymion route, and like we're all speaking abstractly here because those security professionals will have the final say, is it's also a much bigger street. It's a much bigger street. It's much more navigable. And the challenge is going to be also, as you know, that because we have parades running simultaneously on that Saturday, we have to be able to co-host the resources to secure the uptown route and the Endymion route almost simultaneously. But all that being said, generally speaking, it's just a lot of those decisions are going to have a lot more input, which, to be clear, at the end of the day, because we're letting and having security personnel come in and help make those decisions, it will be safer. Let's be very clear. Mardi Gras, now that we have these additional resources, I mean, honestly, if we are going to get federal and state resources to secure both routes simultaneously because of this SEER 1 certification, that's great. You know, Newell, with our existing resources, if we had to secure both, we couldn't do it. We don't have enough cops. We don't have enough vehicles, don't have enough resources. But with SEER 1 certification, if the federal government's going to provide all those additional resources, Governor Landry's made every indication that he will provide resources as necessary, then, I mean, who knows? But the main issue I'm getting to is that certification, that process is no longer going to be limited to Homeland Security and NOPD. They're going to be national and international professionals providing those resources to the federal government as well now.
Do we know, you know, I've been, what I've been saying is about this, it's really not about the bollards. It's really about execution and implementation. And, you know, anytime you have a piece of equipment, whether it's a bollard or a wedge gate or whatever you want to call it, whatever's out there, it doesn't really matter. You got to maintain that equipment. You got to test it. You got to make sure that it's ready each and every time that you're going to utilize it and execute on a security plan. You know, a tactical expert coming in, I guess that's something that you do. We have a plan, but we didn't implement it. And I'm just kind of curious, who decides, you know, like, this is the plan that we're implementing on this day at this time? Because what I'm hearing is that that's not very clear in the governance of the city. Your thoughts?
I think that when it comes, if we're going back to New Year's Day and we're going back to like pre-tactical deployment and how that plan is supposed to be implemented, I think you're 100% right. I think that there, if you look at it from the outside and you look at job descriptions, theoretically, the group that's supposed to be deciding how everything is pre-laid out is Homeland Security. The NOPD is supposed to be a partner in doing that as well. But I think that part of your point, and I think that's kind of going to be, I mean, I will not speculate what the Attorney General's report's going to look like. And I think, honestly, one of the most valuable parts about having the Attorney General do that report is that that is a purely outside person doing a evaluation of what the plan was, if there was a plan, and how that plan was implemented, and giving a concise report on what the deficiencies were. I think that there is certainly, from a tactical perspective, it seems like from the outside looking in, and to be clear, and you know this, Newell, when it comes to tactical implementation of security assets, the council's on the outside looking in. I mean, right. I will tell you, and I'm sure, and I talked to my Jefferson Parish colleagues, the disconnect between us and the administration is kind of breathtaking in that even after this horrific event, the council was never notified there was a terrorist attack at all. We found out when the public found out. And our security briefings, our briefings at all, they all ended, I want to say, Thursday at noon. When I talk to my colleagues, not just in Jefferson Parish, but other cities, they're really just aghast at that you could have a co-equal branch of government that I'm not even saying necessarily we should be involved in security decisions, because that's something that falls within if you had clear lines of command during that strategic security command structure. But just basic information inside of government, when you don't have clear lines of communication, it's just, it's really hard, Newell, looking at this when there's no transparency to assure the public this will be undertaken in a transparent manner. I mean, it's part of why I don't think you saw a lot of pushback from individuals with the Attorney General taking over that tactical investigation. And from our perspective, I will tell you, one party that had absolutely no input on the security infrastructure implementation in the quarter, it was the New Orleans City Council. We were not one of the groups that were consulted on the bollards or the security infrastructure investment. And we're just dealing with who made these decisions and why.
Let's pick up this conversation there. We're visiting with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member at large. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member at large. J.P., you made the observation that the council had no role in this. And obviously, in the structure of governance in the city of New Orleans, the mayor has the lion's share of control in almost everything. How do y'all implement something or make an impact on this as a result of the findings that you may or may not reach relative to your investigation, especially if there's not a clear delineation of command authority over special events in the city like this? And who decides security protocols to be implemented or otherwise? Is that something y'all can do by ordinance, or does it require a city charter amendment, or what?
Well, I think that both are possible remedies to this problem. I think based on what comes back from the Attorney General's report, I think that if there are not clear lines of communication as far as in lines of responsibility when it comes to the tactical implementation, I think that is going to require us to not allow that to become something that is that can be interpreted broadly into ill effect. I think you're probably going to have it either laid in ordinance or in charter who has responsibility, because obviously we have Mardi Gras every year. We have major events every year. There has to be clear lines of who is in command of those situations. As far as the infrastructure missteps, as you know, the council passed an ordinance about 2 years ago to insert itself into the contracting structure when it came to professional service contracts or for contracts that are multi-year over $1 million. That did not include public works low bid contracts. What we're seeing increasingly, not just with the horrific street work that we've had across the city. And I mean, just like, for example, if you look at what's happened throughout the city on Claiborne or other major streets and how they've largely been quagmires where the council bears the brunt of the complaints and concerns of constituents, but we don't get any accountability or responsiveness from the departments that run it, it will probably lead to us through either charter or through ordinance restructuring that as well. Because at the end of the day, we are the ones as a council that are allocating the money for these situations and for these projects in most situations. But when you look at, I'll give you a great example, the infrastructure projects for security were paid for with bond money. Now, when you say that, Newell, you would think that there is a bond service somewhere where it says when we pass these bonds, they are specifically for French Quarter infrastructure improvements. Part of the challenge we have right now with the city's new request for a bond sale is Councilman Geruso and I are giving pushback saying we want specificity on how you're going to spend bond money, because administrations pass bonds, then they kind of move the money around, which makes it difficult for the council to track it. We did not know that the infrastructure money, these infrastructure improvements were paid for with bond money or even which bond money. And we're still trying to figure that out. We know that through documents we've obtained since last week that these millions of dollars on bad bonds were paid for with bonds. But we're still getting back to when were these bonds authorized? Were they specifically for this French Quarter infrastructure upgrades? Who authorized it and who were the checks and balances of this project? Because it just boggles my mind how anybody with any security background, hell, Newell, you are a sheriff, you see these bollards and what they're rated for. Who in the hell signed off that those would be the first line of offense and a multi-layer level of defense?
Look, I asked that question because I recognize that you don't want to have to rely on the heroic actions of the men and women of the NOPD and other law enforcement agencies that are there, right? Because at some point in time, their safety and security is compromised by the inefficiency of the implementation of whatever the security plan is. And in this particular incident, it's ironic, and I know this is a sensitive topic, but you had a man lift in the middle of Bourbon Street that actually probably played as important as a role as almost anything else in bringing an end to this guy driving down Bourbon Street, right? That coupled with the heroic actions of the New Orleans Police Department. That's not what you want to rely on. I also understand that that man lift may not have been permitted. And how it ends up in the middle of Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve night is beyond me.
Well, I'll one step that. Not only was it not permitted, I have it on good authority that there was an attempt made by people within the city to get NOPD to move that lift before New Year's, and it wasn't done timely. So when you talk about a serendipitous kind of mistake as far as someone not checking a box soon enough, that man lift wouldn't have been there. That was not something that was staged by the city to prevent this from happening. It was literally something that was not permanent, that wasn't moved timely.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's like, and thank God for the heroic actions of you know, your NOPD officers. You know,
there was a radio transmitter to set off those two IEDs. Had those officers not reacted swiftly and decisively, this could have been so much worse.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we ought not lose sight of that. And I know that we won't. JP, as always, totally enjoy the conversation with you. Thank you so much for being very outspoken on this issue. Best of luck in the course of this investigation and getting to the bottom of this. And we appreciate the effort, certainly.
I'll be back, Newell, as we get more information.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. That's JP Morrell, New Orleans City Council member at large. Stay with us.